Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, across the country this weekend, organizers say more than 3,000 No Kings rallies took place, including demonstrations in our region. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar was at the rally in Monticello on Saturday and brings us that story. New York lawmakers are racing toward the April 1st deadline for a new state budget as rallies over taxes, immigration, and climate policy fill the Capitol in Albany. New York Public News Network reporters Jimmy Vielkind and Samuel King break down the latest developments. And we'll hear from State Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins on what the Senate wants in the final deal. Maple season is underway, and at a small farm in Delaware County, two brothers are continuing a family tradition, plus a new spring bird walk in Hurleyville. After the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump says Iran must soon reach a deal with the U.S. and immediately reopen the Strait of Hormuz to oil tankers. He wrote online this morning, if Iran fails, the U.S. will blow up all of Iran's electricity plants and oil wells. He also threatened desalination plants. Tens of millions of Iranian civilians need these plants or they cannot get water. Trump also says his administration is talking to a new Iranian regime he described as reasonable. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says there's been a change.
There are clearly people there talking to us in ways that previous people in charge in Iran have not spoken to us in the past. Some of the things they're willing to do, some of the things they're saying they're willing to do. Obviously, they have to go do it. We're going to test that proposition very strongly because we always prefer to settle things through negotiation and diplomacy.
However, the Trump administration continues to send more U.S. troops to the Mideast to join others who are already there. About 50,000 U.S. troops are now in the region. Iran's capital experienced mass power outages over the weekend after airstrikes damaged power facilities. Now, Russia's State Nuclear Energy Corporation warns ongoing U.S. and Israeli strikes are endangering a nuclear power plant in southern Iran. NPR's Emily Fang reports.
Iranian state media says shrapnel from weekend strikes damaged power equipment in Tehran and nearby Karaj city, leading to hours-long blackouts in both places. Israel said over the weekend it had hit some 140 targets in Iran. Iran said several of those strikes hit universities and is now threatening to hit U.S. campuses in the Middle East in retaliation. Meanwhile, Russia's state nuclear energy corporation Rosatom is warning that strikes are deteriorating the condition of Iran's Bushehr nuclear plant. Rosatom helped build the Bushehr plant, which has been hit multiple times during the war. No damage has been reported from those strikes, but more than 160 Rosatom staff members have returned to Russia, according to the company, with more evacuations planned from the plant in the coming days. Emily Fang, NPR News, Van, Turkey.
Stocks open mixed this morning as crude oil prices continue to climb. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow's up about 200 points.
Crude oil prices in the U.S. jumped back above $100 a barrel. Retail gasoline prices are hovering just below $4 a gallon. Traders are trying to sort through mixed signals about the U.S. and Israel's war with Iran. That country has retaliated with attacks on energy infrastructure in both Israel and Kuwait. Yemen's Houthi rebels also fired missiles at Israel, raising concern the Iranian-backed group might resume its attacks on commercial shipping traffic in the Red Sea. That would add another complication for global commerce, already squeezed by Iran's chokehold on the Strait of Hormuz. Asian stocks were mixed overnight, down in Tokyo, Seoul, and Hong Kong, but slightly higher in Shanghai. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News. The Bank of America has agreed to pay more than $72 million to survivors of Jeffrey Epstein's sex trafficking ring. The civil lawsuit alleged the bank enabled and profited from his crimes. The Bank of America does not admit wrongdoing in the case, and it insists it did not facilitate sex trafficking crimes. But bank officials say the settlement provides closure for victims. People in two states in the Midwest have only days left to register to vote in upcoming primary elections. NPR's Hansi Lo Wang has more.
To vote in Indiana and Ohio's primaries in May, eligible voters have to be registered by April 6. There are still a few weeks left to register in time for the primaries in Georgia, Kentucky, Louisiana, and West Virginia. If you've already registered to vote, you may want to check your status before your state's deadline. Eligible voters can sometimes be removed from lists, especially if they move, change their name, or haven't voted in a while. And if you're planning to register to vote by mail, you may want to avoid waiting until the last minute to send in your application by a postmark deadline. Changes at the U.S. Postal Service mean that your mail may not get a postmark on the same day you drop it off. USPS says if you want to make sure it gets a postmark, stop by a post office and ask for one. Anzila Wong, NPR News.
A teenager in Vermont is running for governor and will appear on the general election ballot this fall. 14-year-old Dean Roy created his own third party, the Freedom and Unity Party, to secure his place on the Vermont ballot. Roy says he does not identify with either major party. He also does not expect to win. Roy says he is seeking to create change. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Lemelson Foundation, dedicated to improving lives through invention, innovation, and climate action. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at wtgrantfdn.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. More than 3,000 No Kings rallies took place across the country this past weekend, according to organizers. Nationwide, people rallied from New York City, with almost 8.5 million residents in a solidly blue state, to Driggs, a town of fewer than 2,000 people in eastern Idaho, a state President Trump carried with 66% of the vote in 2024. In Minnesota, a flagship event on the Capitol lawn in St. Paul drew Bruce Springsteen as its headliner to celebrate resistance to Trump's aggressive immigration enforcement. Demonstrations were also held in more than a dozen other countries, according to Indivisible, the organization which spearheaded the events. U.S. organizers have estimated that the first two rounds of No Kings rallies drew more than 5 million people in June, 7 million in October, and Indivisible estimated that at least 8 million participants showed up on Saturday. In our region, folks rallied in Monticello, Allenville, Warwick, Middletown, Honesdale, Kingston, and more. Radio Catskills Kimberly Izar was at the Monticello rally on Saturday and brings us this report.
Come, senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block out the hall.
The windy, cold temperatures on Saturday didn't stop people from joining the No Kings rally on Broadway in Monticello. Protesters held signs and played songs about change and resistance to push back against President Donald Trump's administration. Calhoun resident Charlie Trowbridge says his reason for showing up is simple.
I just wanted to stand up for our democracy. I think that our democracy is in danger, and we need to make it clear. I want to stand with the people in Minnesota who are really battered this winter, and I want to stand with all my fellow citizens here.
Saturday was the third No Kings rally in Sullivan County, one of more than 3,000 events that took place across the country, according to organizers. Monticello resident Nancy Filipovitz described the Trump administration as, quote, lawless. Affordability was an issue top of mind for her and many others Radio Catskill spoke with.
I no longer can afford health insurance, and I have had cancer in the past, which I cannot have follow-ups with because I cannot afford health insurance.
Can you talk a little bit more about the rise of healthcare prices?
Oh, goodness. It has more than doubled, and along with all of the other expenses and the rising cost of living, has made it impossible to afford it. It's a culmination of unaffordability, and it's literally killing people as we speak.
Grahamsville resident Tim Redman says he's never seen costs so high.
You know, I'm fairly old at this point, and I've never seen anything like this before in this country. It's insane. You know, prices of everything are definitely noticeably going up. I'm not sure that I've ever really noticed that before, as much as what I notice it now. Trump and his enablers, they're apparently making millions and billions of dollars, and the rest of us are just falling further behind.
The war in Iran was also on people's minds. In February, the U.S. and Israel attacked Iran in a series of military airstrikes. Iran has since retaliated, with consequences that have spilled across the Middle East region. Sullivan County resident Paula McDonald says watching the war unfold has been upsetting and dire.
I'm feeling that this is getting more and more urgent, and the fact that we're in a war now, that is really unnecessary. And it's driving costs up even more, and I think families are really hurting, and it's just not necessary. And I would like this to stop, and I would like the lying to stop.
Step by step, the longest march can be won.
It's in your notes.
Can be won.
It's on the lyric sheet.
About 40 miles from Monticello was another No Kings rally in Honesdale, Pennsylvania. Hundreds gathered on Main Street and also sang songs of resistance. Radio Catskill contributor Rosie Starr chatted with Tanis Kowalczyk, who helped form the Singing Resistance NEPA Choir back in February.
And we were also really inspired by the Singing Resistance that started in Minneapolis when ICE was really occupying that city and doing a lot of damage there. And so we were inspired by that and took some of their music, because they have a public songbook, and then found some music that we as a group were interested in as well. So it was just such a pleasure to sing together, and also to teach our community here who came out to No Kings Day in Honesdale a couple of the songs, and they were really thrilled to sing. It's nice to sing together, right? It just brings you together and it opens up your heart, and just makes you feel like you're one unity.
Singling up, one more time. Step by step, the longest march. Sing with us. Can be won, can be won.
In Monticello, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
After the break, a closer look at what's happening in Albany as budget negotiations intensify and the budget deadline approaches. Stay with us. This is Radio Catskill.
Support comes from Sullivan Allies Leading Together, committed to ensuring the safety of our community. Protect those most important by keeping medications in a secure space. Be a part of the solution. More at saltcares.com.
President Trump issued an executive order on his first day back in office seeking to end birthright citizenship for the children of some immigrants. Every court that has considered the order so far has blocked it. Now, the Supreme Court will weigh in. I'm Washington correspondent Miles Parks. Join us for live special coverage and analysis from NPR News of the Supreme Court oral arguments over birthright citizenship.
Wednesday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. New York State's budget is officially due this week, April 1st. The New York State Capitol has been flooded with rallies over climate, immigration, and tax policy as Albany lawmakers hurried toward that state budget deadline. New York Public News Network reporters Jimmy Vielkind and Samuel King break down the latest developments.
Hi, Jimmy.
Hi, Samuel.
While the state budget is due in less than a week, it will be more than $263 billion, and it's filled with some major policy proposals. So what's the latest?
You know, there's actually hasn't been much tangible progress on any of the big issues, Samuel. We haven't had an update from either Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins or Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie on the status of talks. And Governor Hochul actually left the Capitol to tout her agenda in cities around the state. Not really a sign of major progress. She said this in Syracuse when asked whether there will be a budget by the April 1st deadline.
I always strive for an on-time budget. It's due April 1st, but I'm just working hard to try and persuade people that I'm fighting for New Yorkers. I'm not a special interest. They're not special interests. And we have to be louder than the special interests.
The big sticking points include changes to the payout rules for auto insurance, the environmental reviews for housing projects, and, of course, whether or not to raise taxes.
And don't forget climate policy, Jimmy. Hochul wants to make it easier for the state to meet its deadlines for cutting greenhouse gas emissions. She says it would cost taxpayers too much money to get the state into compliance with the law as it's written. Environmental groups came out and forced to push back. Demonstrators lined the skinny hallway that a lot of lawmakers use to get into the state capitol. Picture like a gauntlet of protesters on both sides as lawmakers and lobbyists walk by. Here's what that sounded like. Some demonstrators were arrested for blocking key entrances.
Yeah, there was a similar rally of immigration advocates. There were dozens of people who sat in the street in a bid to pass the New York For All Act. That would severely restrict cooperation between local police and federal immigration authorities. Cassandra Bocanegra of the New York Immigration Coalition says they want to make sure that the legislature doesn't water down those cooperation restrictions in a final bill.
We need everyone to be protected. We need all of New York For All to pass. Our criminal justice system and our immigration system are two separate systems.
Some moderate Democrats, including Hochul, are pushing for some carve-outs. You know, they want police to be able to talk to immigration agents after people are convicted of serious crimes. These talks are moving in parallel to the budget, so changes might get folded in.
Another issue, you say?
That's right. Now, Samuel, you did some reporting on dollars and cents, God forbid, you know, funding for upstate transit systems.
Yes, they're looking for a 15% increase in transit funding for upstate agencies. So far, they have that in the Senate proposal, but the Assembly and Governor proposed less. Without it, some agencies say there could be more service cuts. Here's the CEO of the Capital District Transportation Authority, Frank Anacaro.
CDTA will have to make tough decisions that include service reductions this May, with additional impacts coming in August. The time to ensure this does not happen is right now.
Well, Jimmy, you've been doing this for a long time. Is the budget going to be late?
Most people I'm talking with say yes, including State Senator Jim Todisco. He's a Republican from the Capital Region, but he's the longest-serving state lawmaker right now. Republicans aren't really at the negotiating table, but Todisco says Democrats have just bitten off too much spending and too many policies.
And that's the single most important thing we're elected to do. And I don't know how long we were, close to 2 months last year, late with a budget. And I think we're in a worse economic condition right now.
Oh, my.
Yeah, we'll see if he's right.
We'll talk soon, Jimmy.
Take care.
Thanks to the New York Public News Network reporters Jimmy Vielkind and Samuel King for that. Now, state lawmakers left Albany's late last week with little confidence that they would pass the budget before the April 1st deadline. The legislature managed to pass one of 10 budget bills on Thursday, paying for the state's debt. But Democrats in the majority made clear during that debate they don't see a path to a deal. Earlier, Chantal Destra of WMHT and the New York Public News Network sat down with State Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins to dig deeper into the state's Senate's one-house budget resolution, increased taxes on wealthy New Yorkers, the budget negotiation process, immigration, climate policies, and more.
Thank you so much for joining us back on the show today, Leader.
It's always good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Now, the Senate's One House budget resolution included increased taxes for wealthy New Yorkers. I know that this is something that the chamber has included in its resolutions year after year. Meanwhile, Governor Kathy Hochul has stated that she's not interested in increasing taxes on wealthy New Yorkers. So how far is the chamber going to go to push the governor to include it in the final enacted budget?
Well, as you know, we do put it in our one house because in our one house, we talk about our priorities. And as you said, we are trying to meet those priorities and we've got to obviously generate revenue. And so in our one house, we continue to ask those who are the wealthiest among us to do just a little bit more, you know, in order to accommodate for what's happening on a federal level, with the variety of cuts that are happening in the hospital spaces, health spaces, education, you name it, food insecurity. So we are looking at the environment, looking at where we are now and where we need to be in terms of making sure that New Yorkers have what they need. So yes, we do ask for those who can give a little more, do a little more. We're trying to expand childcare. We're trying to help child care workers. We know that there's a number of people who we know are hungry, and we've had to invest more now in food banks, etc. So there are just so many needs that we're trying to make sure we meet on the education space, health space, you name it, and we're trying to meet it.
Do you think that there's a way to compromise and meet in the middle between what your chamber wants and what the governor wants on this issue?
Well, just so your viewers understand the process, the governor presents, you know, her bill, her list of things she wants for her budget, and then each house then puts forward our priorities in the one houses. So we just completed that one house process. We've, you know, voted on it. And so now we're negotiating in earnest the priorities that each of us really are pushing. So there's always a negotiation. There's always a conversation about how best to meet the needs. But the conversation this year, as you have heard over and over again, is affordability. And we're trying to figure out how to keep more money in you know, working New Yorkers' pockets, as well as try and meet the needs that we know people have. So that's what the negotiation is going to be about. And, you know, ultimately, our budget deadline is April 1st, and we are going to be moving to hopefully meet that deadline.
And what do you say to the concerns that increased taxes on wealthy New Yorkers will drive out migration?
Well, you know, I think that, again, New Yorkers, I feel, are a very, very special breed of people. We know, I want to believe that we're in the greatest state in this great country because we understand what's important. We invest in our people, we invest in education, we invest in healthcare, we invest in environment, and we invest in housing. We are doing the kinds of things that people expect us to do. We're trying to provide opportunities for our children, not only in education, but whether it's after school programs. There are so many things that we as New Yorkers are expected to do in order to continue to lead, but also to maintain what we know are important things. So, you know, we've gotten, frankly, more millionaires over the past few years. And again, we certainly want everyone to stay. And in an environment that is so threatening in so many ways, I think we can come together and fund the priorities that we know is important to everyone and get the work done. So I don't believe people are going to leave. I don't want them to leave. As I said, we're talking about, you know, 0.5% more on some of the wealthiest people and the wealthiest corporations, which will go a long way to make sure people are able to have health care and food and education, child care, and things that we know are important.
And the Chamber's One House resolution also included measures to help New Yorkers with the high cost of utility rates by way of different programs like the heat pump rebate program, as well as different assistance and affordability measures. So can you tell us how big of an issue this is in the state and why this was important for your conference to include?
Well, it's huge. And as a conference, we have, since the beginning of the year, been pushing different pieces of legislation. We've put together packages to really address the costs that people are really feeling around utilities and trying to get a handle, whether it's transparency, whether it's more accountability, whether it's making sure that there's just not a lot of miscellaneous you know, interests that are being put into these utility bills, more understanding, you know, of delivery charges that somehow, you know, exceed exponentially the actual charge of the actual cost of the electricity or the gas that you're getting. There's so much that we can do. We're also in our one house budget trying to help consumers navigate the process and have some assistance in really fighting electric bills that they can't quite understand. So there is so much to be done, and it is extremely important. There's not a time, frankly, that I go back into the community that somebody isn't saying to me, can you help me with these Con Edison bills? People, I mean, we have Con Edison, but I'm sure all over the state, no matter who your carrier is, people are really crying out for help. So in our one house, we've endeavored to start trying to get at the root of it, whether it's the Public Service Commission really examining these rate cases a bit more, really making sure that we're not just making sure shareholders are doing great and constituents are suffering. If the company is making this much money, let's get it back into people's pockets and let's lower these rates. So we are trying to really push in that way, as is the assembly. I mean, you know, the governor, we all understand that utilities really are among the highest that it's ever been, and it's really on top of mind for New Yorkers.
And we know the budget has been delayed or late in the past few years, and the assembly has been pretty infamous for not wanting to include policy in the budget. Assembly Speaker Carl Hasty has said time and time again, policy is what makes the budget delayed. So I was curious, do you think your conference will ever take up the position to not include policy in the budget moving forward to sort of speed up the negotiation
process? Well, I don't know that that's the case. And generally, the governor doesn't feel that way. The governor puts policy, every governor that I've worked with has put policy in the budget. So, you know, we're dealing with policy in the budget one way or the other. And for us, we have things that we'd like to see done as well. So we put it in our one house bill and we negotiate around that. It's not our policies, frankly, that have ever delayed the budget. Yes, it would be nice if we're only talking about finances, but the reality is that there's always policy there. We've got to negotiate, we've got to figure it out, and we've got to get a budget. And somehow we always do.
And from your purview, how can the budget process and negotiation process be improved and improve transparency in the years to come?
You know, it's something that I wish I had a good answer to. There are 213 members in the legislature and one governor. And, you know, I've got to figure out how to get the majority of 63 votes, and the speaker has to figure out how to get the majority of 150 votes. And, you know, for me, in my conference, we have work groups around all of the areas of interest so that people have input into what kinds of things they would like to have, you know, us fight for in the budget. A lot of negotiation is done with staff, and it's a lot of back and forth with members in order to at least have people involved. We also have presentations, at least for our members, so that they understand what's going on in other areas of interest. The committee meetings are open, obviously, but in terms of people really getting to see every piece of how the quote-unquote the sausage is made, I don't know how to make that easier. But I will say that the representatives, the folks who are in conference in the Senate, you know, do have a good understanding of all the pieces of the budget because we try and make people aware. And so that when they're voting from a knowledge base that is comprehensive, not just their little area, but the entirety. Now, there's people, obviously, if you're, you know, interested in agriculture, that's where your focus is. If you're interested, and rather, if you're the chair of this committee, that's where your focus has to be. But you're also going to be aware of what else is happening. So I've really endeavored to make it a more inclusive body so that although people say there's three, used to be three men in the room, but now there's, you know, two women and one man. But the reality is that, yes, ultimately, three people, you know, sign off, but for Speaker Hasty and for myself, that sign off comes with the buy-in of the vast majority of our bodies based on information, based on knowledge, based on need.
And would you say that level of transparency is consistent when messages of necessities are being used to pass the budget? I know that there's been a lot of conversation to try to not do messages of necessities, especially when the budget is late. Do you have any perspective on that?
You know, again, we do endeavor to get an on-time budget, and I think everybody's better off when the information is in the public view. Longer, you know, I mean, we usually look for at least being out 3 days. And so that is really the optimum, and I don't think any of us like messages of necessity, but sometimes they are necessary, which is why they're called messages of necessity. But I think for all of us, we would rather a process that, you know, allows for the legislation, the budget, whatever it is, to be in the public eye for the requisite at least 3 days, so that people have an idea of what's in it and they'd be able to comment on it, etc. So we try and use it very, very, you know, infrequently.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to immigration, I know the governor in her executive budget proposal included many measures to protect immigrant New Yorkers this year. I didn't see too much of that in the One House budget resolutions in either chamber. And there was, of course, some conversation about an omnibus package.
Right.
So have there been any developments on that? I know, obviously, the budget talks are starting in earnest, but any developments on immigration there?
Well, we are talking, I think, if, you know, for us, this has been top of mind. In fact, in my opening statement, I talked about trying to get to, you know, the goals and principles of New York for All. I've been very clear about that, as is my conference. And what we do want to do is get a three-way agreement, because we know how important it is to protect New Yorkers, protect our immigrant community, and make sure that, you know, the places and spaces that we can cover, we are collectively covering, and we pass legislation that is effective. So we are having productive conversations. Just in the past week or two, you know, three-way conversations. So it is my hope that we will be able to definitely get a package out soon, very soon. As I said, it's kind of at this point on parallel tracks, because we do have a lot of conversation going on around the budget as well. So, you know, we left a space open. We didn't put all of our different pieces of legislation in, because who knows, we may be able to do it actually before the budget. However, you know, if not, we certainly will be able to do it, hopefully within the budget. But we are really, really, really very, very serious about making sure that we address this moment in the appropriate way for all of us.
And when it comes to the 2019 climate law that essentially works to reduce gas emissions in the state, I know NYSERDA recently put out a memo saying there was some concerns about whether or not the state would be able to reach those goals by 2030. Several Democrats in your conference sent a letter to the governor saying they would not be on board with any changes to that law. So I wanted to get your perspective on that. And also, have you been briefed by the executive chamber about any changes to the climate law?
Well, very recently, the governor did speak about, you know, some of the things, some of the dates, deadlines, etc., and, you know, her concern around those things. So, I mean, you know, she's grappling with the goals and how to meet the goals in a timely basis. We are really, really, I think we really are concerned about the climate change and being ready and making sure that we're, you know, stewards of the environment. We're also worried about, you know, everything else. So I think, you know, as soon as we get get something that the governor is really beyond, you know, the dates, but, you know, where are we going? How do we continue our progress? This is so important. It's important for our planet, it's important for our state to continue to lead, and it's important for the next generation to understand that we're serious about climate change and meeting the needs of the planet, and you know. So as soon as we get some concrete details from the governor, I think we could be able to talk about it in earnest and get, like you said, to a place we believe we can, you know, work on saving the planet, work on, you know, meeting deadlines, And we'll do what we have to do in order to make sure that, that New York and New Yorkers are not only conscious of the environmental issues, but also feel that we're progressing in meeting the challenges.
And a few weeks ago, your Deputy Senate Majority Leader, Mike Gianaris, he announced that he wouldn't be running for re-election. And I know that this represents sort of a major void in the chamber because he's so influential in getting, you know, the chamber's legislative priorities over the finish line. So I was just curious, you know, what are some of the qualities that you're looking for in the next deputy leader? And, you know, do you have a time frame on when that person, you know, will be ascended to the role?
Well, first of all, he's still here.
Yes,
he's very much here.
Yes.
And he will be here certainly through the end of session. So I, you know, I'm not worried about replacing him between now and the end of session. And, you know, I, whatever he does, he's been an incredible partner and a good friend. And as you said, really instrumental in helping, you know, make sure that the trains stay on track and we get our legislative agenda through. And, you know, he's been a fabulous partner. So, you know, I look for what everybody looks for, which is someone who, you know, gets it, who understands that in this environment, you know, first of all, you have to like what you're doing. You have to really enjoy, because it's not easy. It kind of looks easy, maybe for some people outside, but it isn't. Somebody who respects the opinions of their colleagues, somebody who is willing to listen to all of the different voices, because you do need the different voices when you decide on the direction to go with legislative priorities and everything else, quite frankly. It's important that you get as much input and that you value that input and that you're able to process the input and that you're able to communicate it. So those are things that are really, really valuable. And a respect, obviously, each of us have been elected by our respective communities to show up here and vote on behalf of people, in our case, mostly over 300,000 people in each of our districts. So we are all leaders. So, you know, everyone has a voice, everyone has a perspective, and that has to be respected as well. So I think those are the qualities in general. And the good news, of course, is that they're, you know, most of everybody in our conference is like that. You know, we've been able to be successful since we took the majority in 2019. And we've been able to grow. We've been the largest supermajority that the chamber's ever had. We're the most diverse demographically and geographically that's ever been here. And so we've learned the art of listening. We've learned the art of engaging each other and asking tough questions and coming to decisions that, you know, people can at least, you know, they may not agree with everything, but they respect the process. So, I'm going to be looking to Senator Gianaris too, you know, to kind of, you know, make those decisions about, you know, who, what. But I really say we have an embarrassment of riches, because there are many, many, many great senators who, you know, can step up and lead.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today, Leader. I'm so happy that we were able to have this in-depth conversation.
Well, I really, really appreciate the conversation. Thanks so much.
And we were speaking with State Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stork-Cousins.
And that was Chantel Destra from the New York Public News Network. Coming up, a trip inside a Delaware County sap house where the science and craft of maple syrup mean every batch tastes a little different. We'll hear from one of the farmers behind Brookside Maple and Farm after the break. This is Radio Chatskill.
This week on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we've got jazz for the original swinger, the new exotic sounds of Mr. Moai and the Tiki Heads, plus TV Private Eye Jazz by Pete Rugolo. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music's shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7:00. here on Radio Catskill.
Nearly all bicycles sold in America are built overseas, but an Indiana company wants to put the brakes on that with a bike factory here in the U.S.
They could make a difference with their idea of bringing manufacturing back. This is an area that knows manufacturing.
Could high tariffs on foreign competitors give a helpful push? That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen to All Things Considered this afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Maple season is a busy time at Brookside Maple and Farm in Delancey, New York. Farmer Matthew Scobie runs the Delaware County operation with his brother Micah. The brothers grew up in a farming family. Their parents raised beef cattle and produced maple syrup. And in 2008, when they were still teenagers, they built the farm's sap house. Today, they continue that tradition, producing maple syrup that reflects the subtle differences of each batch. On Farm and Country Saturday, Kimberly Izar spoke with Matthew Scobie about how the syrup is made and why no two bottles are ever quite the same.
You know, for folks who might not be too familiar with kind of that process between from tree to harvest to production, what goes into that? Walk me through it a little bit.
Yep. So all of our trees are on leased land, and that all the tubing runs from tree to tree, and then the sap runs through the tubing, which is 5/16. That then runs into 1-inch tubing, and then 1.5 inches, runs all the way down the hill a few thousand feet, and then it runs to a collecting tank. There we use a vacuum pump to help, we'll say, pull the sap through the lines. Really just makes it easier for the trees to push that sap out. It goes into a tank there, and then we truck it from those couple holding tanks down to the sap house, where it goes into a 4,500-gallon tank, and then into the reverse osmosis, which basically like a filter, but we're purifying water, but we're throwing away the pure water. We're keeping the concentrated sap. So we're getting rid of at minimum 2/3 of the water out of the sap before we even boil it. These days, it's really hard to be profitable without a reverse osmosis. It's just a huge time saver and saves big on fuel. We run it through the evaporator. It's going in at, we'll say, 18 to 20% sugar. It's coming out of the tree at, we'll say, 1.2 to 2% sugar. So that reverse osmosis is doing most of the legwork. And then it goes into the evaporator, and it's coming out at 66 to 68% sugar. And then we filter it through a filter press, and then it goes into stainless steel barrels, which we then use to bottle through the rest of the year. And then when we have an order or we need to stock our shelves, we'll empty one of those barrels, reheat it to at least 180 degrees, and then we'll bottle it from there in whatever we need to bottle that day.
How long does that take exactly? How long is that timeline?
Yep. So last night we checked on the tanks. There's barely anything in them. And now today it's about 1:30 and we have almost 8,000 gallons of sap. So we'll have all that trucked down here within the next 2 or 3 hours, and then we'll run it through the reverse osmosis, and it'll be made into syrup tonight.
Wow. Okay, so 8,000 gallons, that's a lot.
Yeah. We're actually hoping for like 10,000 or more today.
Oh my gosh, that is amazing.
It's going to be a late night.
And how many taps do you guys have here?
Yep, so we have 5,000. We have 1,400 on one sap bush, we'll call it, and then 3,600 on the other. And so they're giving us like at least 2 gallons per tap of sap a day right now.
I'm curious if you've seen, you know, the changing climate change impact maple sapping and what that's looked like year after year.
Yep. So, I mean, it's pretty typical every spring. You're going to go from winter to spring either way. Back 10 years ago, we still had days or seasons where all of a sudden we would have 70 degree days and cut these seasons short. I think it was 2017 or 2019, we actually had a 18-day season. And so last year wasn't great for us, but spring's always going to show up. But we might be making syrup in January or February like last year. And then it never really had great runs last year. Sugar content was low. This year, it was cold all winter, which actually helps the trees. It puts them into more of their cycle. this spring. As soon as it started running last week, it ran solid for 9 days, and we made almost two-thirds what we made all last year. If the weather holds, we'll actually make more this year per tap than last year. But again, there's a lot to it. You have to have sun in the summer because that tree needs to take the sunlight and turn that into food through photosynthesis. And then you need to have water in the ground for that tree to have enough sap to have the flow. There's a lot of variables, and there's really a lot to it, but we're always going to have spring. It's just a matter of, is it going to be a little bit earlier this year, a little bit later?
Talk to me a little bit about the beginning of this farm and how you got into maple sapping.
We actually started making syrup with our father across the road. And then all that ended up getting sold. And 2008, my brother and I decided we wanted to do our own thing and get back into it. So we built our first small sap house. That summer, we were making syrup in February of 2009, and he was 14, I was 15 at the time, and we had a lot of help from a couple people in the neighborhood, Tom Kaufman being one of them. He said, you get a building built, I'll find you an evaporator cheap. So we had a cheap one, we had to put some work into it. That first year, I think we made 120 gallons. Now we make that or more in a night. So we've came a long way. When I went to college, we had to get a little more efficient. That's when we bought the first small reverse osmosis so that my brother could handle it on his own. And now myself and my brother, we both have small children. Mine's 16 months old. My brother's is just about 4 months now. It's been a long road to get where we are, but we have big plans to keep expanding. It's what we like to do, you know. The old saying is make hay when the sun shines. Well, we got to make syrup when the weather permits too. So
that's a beautiful saying. And what would you say is your favorite thing about this? Like what sparks your light?
I don't know. I guess just the whole thing. I mean, like days today where it's running really good, it's kind of fun to just be trucking sap as fast as you can, see how quick you can get a truck filled up, brought back, unloaded. We're always pushing to do better, so we're like pushing the reverse osmosis. What can we, how efficient can we run that? How many gallons of syrup can we make an hour? You know, how many barrels can we make in a night? And then, you know, we have our logo, our brand on a lot of different bottles, and it's nice to go into a little store in the community and there's your stuff on the shelf. And we grew up doing it, and we're excited to have our sons help us with that. And you know, any other kids in the future as well. So it's nice to ideally have something to pass on as well.
Well, I guess before we sign off, do you want to let folks know where they could find you?
Yeah, so we have a website, brooksidemapleandfarm.com. We have all of our products on our website. We also have a Facebook, Brookside Maple and Farm, and then Instagram, Brookside Maple and Farm.
And thanks to Kimberly Izar for that report. You know, it's a sign of spring when they're trucking sap. It's getting warmer and the birds are back. Coming up, we'll learn how the O&W Rail Trail in Hurleyville is becoming a hot spot for bird watchers this spring. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills, with campuses in Harris and Calicoon, offering inpatient and outpatient services to Sullivan County and surrounding communities. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
I'm Stephen Dubner on the next Freakonomics Radio.
Wherever there is history being made, the commodity traders are there.
Commodity traders often operate in the shadows, and their reach is enormous.
They are the bankers of last resort, and they are almost like diplomats for hire.
The most powerful people you've never heard of. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Tuesday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
Feel like you're just spinning in an endless whirlpool of information? We can help steady you. I'm Brooke Gladstone, co-host of On the Media, and we point out where you should be paying attention and what you can afford to ignore. Using the media as a lens on our world, we reveal nuance and detail often missed by other outlets. So don't miss On the Media, Saturday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Spring migration is underway, and bird watchers say this is one of the best times of the year to spot returning species. A new event in Hurleyville is inviting people to experience that seasonal change up close. The Sullivan County Audubon Society and the Sullivan O&W Rail Trail Alliance are hosting their first ever bird walk along the historic O&W Rail Trail on April 25th. Timed with National Go Birding Day and Celebrate Trails Day. Joining us now is Helen Budrock with the Sullivan ONW Rail Trail Alliance. For more, Helen, thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for inviting me.
So tell us about this event on the 25th. What's this inaugural bird walk all about, and how did it come to be with the alliance between your alliance and the Audubon Society?
Well, when we started doing events for the Alliance, which was probably, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, we came up with the idea to kind of play off of the O&W. So we have a bunch of signature events. One is called the Snow and W, or the Snow, in the wintertime. We have the Bow Wow, which is a dog-themed event in the summer. And then in the fall, we have the Howl, or the Howl and W. We were kind of like missing something in the spring. So, we had an epiphany one day and we were like, foul.
You're going all in with the
I know, with
cheeky...
the whole O&W thing, yeah. Right? Exactly. So the idea was to have, our first ever inaugural, bird watching event called the Foul. And it just so happens that the section, along the rail trail in Hurleyville, which I think a lot of people are familiar with because it's probably one of the most popular because it's the paved section, goes by Shattuck Pond, and it happens to be a very popular, place for bird watching.
Talk a little bit about that for folks who may not be familiar with it. Why is that particular area of the rail trail a good place for bird watching?
Well, I'm not a bird, you know, sort of expert. That's why we have the Audubon Society coming with us. But basically, it's a huge pond surrounded by wetlands. So it's a great spot to watch birds, waterfowl, all kinds of migratory birds. They congregate there because that's where the food is, and that's where they nest and breed. So I know myself, I've seen some herons and some other birds that I couldn't even tell you what they are, but they're beautiful.
Well, people get to learn what those are on this day. Now,
exactly.
This is coinciding with two national observances that I mentioned, Go Birding Day and Celebrate Trails Day. Why was it important to connect the local event with those larger efforts?
It made sense. We always do something on National Trails Day, which is in June, and we were thinking, okay, it would be nice to have something to go along with, the Celebrate Trails Day, which is a specific event that was sponsored by the National sort of Rail Trail Alliance, so it's specific to rail trails. And then when we discovered that it also happens to be National Go Birding Day, it just seemed like it all made sense, right? Like it was meant to be. So we put the two together.
You got it.
At the Sullivan Audubon, and, you know, it came together.
That's good. And so you mentioned that you yourself are not necessarily an experienced birder, but
correct.
You don't need to be, right? It's something anyone can enjoy.
No, and that's the whole beauty of it is that, you know, you get to go out, you get to, you know, be with some experts and, you know, get educated about what birds are out there and how the ecosystem works. So it should be a lot of fun. And we're actually, anybody who comes, we're going to enter their name in a hat for a book, which is basically The Birds of Sullivan County. So you never know. You might come out and you might learn something and you might walk away with a book and become a birder. You just never know.
Walk us through what the day's like. So when you get there in the morning, what's it going to look like for folks who show up?
Yeah, so I was told by the Audubon folks that the best time of day to spot birds is early in the morning or late in the day around sunset. So I'm not a morning person, but the people picked 8 a.m., so we're going to be out there bright and early on a Saturday morning. We're going to gather at the trailhead on Main Street in Hurleyville, and it's about, that section of trail is about a mile long. I don't think we'll go that far. We'll probably go about a half a mile, you know, sort of out and back. We'll be able to, you know, position ourselves to be able to get some good vantage points along Shattuck Pond. And then after the trail, everybody is invited to meet at Forage and Gather, which is a local cafe in Hurleyville. And we'll have coupons for the first 30 people to enjoy a nice hot beverage and a snack on us. So,
well, good. And what should people bring with them if they want to participate? Binoculars, cameras, maybe coffee?
Yes, for sure. Yeah, binoculars, cameras. We're asking people to please leave their dogs at home, even though they may be well behaved. We don't want to, startle any of the birds. But other than that, just, wear comfortable shoes. Hopefully the weather will be good, and just enjoy.
I want to ask you a little bit more about the O&W Rail Trail Alliance, and you guys work mm-hmm. to steward, promote the trail. How do events like this help people connect with that mission?
It's just about raising awareness. A lot of people are aware of the trail in their backyard. For example, I live in Hurleyville, so I've always been, sort of conscious of that section. But a lot of people don't realize that, the rail trail in Mountaindale and the rail trail in Parksville and in downtown Liberty, it's all the same trail and it's all connected. So this raises awareness and gets people out, looking at different sections of the trail, and it's a different experience each time.
And talk about the role volunteers and community partners play in keeping the trail active and accessible.
Oh, my gosh, there's so many of them. Sullivan 180 is a great partner because they have their Healthiest Fire Department Challenge, and they really sort of get people out on the trail for our events. Cornell Cooperative Extension, they have sort of a Healthy Communities program, and they have funded bicycle repair stations and benches and signage all along, all sections of the trail. Obviously, Sullivan County government has been a huge partner in sort of helping support the alliance. We've been standing on our own now for, I think it's maybe 3 or 4 years that we're now an independent organization. We have a fiscal sponsorship with Catskill Mountain Keeper. So it's basically all volunteer driven, and everybody, is just passionate about the trail and getting the word out.
And if folks want to learn more about the trail and the bird walk, where can they find that information?
You can go to SullivanONW.com. That's sort of spelt out O-A-N-D-W. We're on Facebook. We're on Instagram. So, like our pages. And, that's pretty much where you'll get the best information on what we have going on.
And again, that inaugural Go Birding Day, Celebrate Trails Day, O&W Rail Trail. What is it? Fowl?
Fowl Day.
It's April 25th, and it's a partnership between the Sullivan O&W Rail Trail Alliance and the Sullivan County Audubon Society. They're mentioning that you might see cardinals, maybe even a great blue heron. Are you expecting to see or hoping to see something, Helen?
I'm hoping we'll see some birds, because after all, it is a bird walk, so we'll have to have somebody in the background cue the birds.
Yeah, and you're open to any bird at this point. You're whatever shows up is great.
Yeah, exactly. Release the doves. It's all good.
Helen Budruck from the Sullivan O&W Rail Trail Alliance. Have fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right. Thank you. Bye.
All right, that's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Programming note, a reminder that on Wednesday at 10, we'll be bringing you the live debate in the Supreme Court, the live hearing about birthright citizenship from NPR News. That starts at 10 on Wednesday. But we'll be back here tomorrow. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, theater lovers. It's Tom Candela from Curtain Call. This week on the show, acclaimed director Scott Ellis, Tony nominated for productions like She Loves Me and Tootsie, and a Drama Desk Award winner. We go inside the craft of directing, from shaping performance and building ensemble to the delicate balance between honoring a classic and bringing it to life for today's audience. Plus a look at his latest production of Noel Coward's Fallen Angels. It's Curtain Call, found only at WJFFradio.org.
On the next Radiolab, we dance the forbidden dance between sweet, calming order and...
Oh my God.
Chaos.
Dead.
Extinct. Three stories...
It's like a microbial Game of Thrones.
...about our natural world...
The circle of life.
...and the harmonious pattern underneath it that may or may not exist. Life in a barrel. That's on the next Radiolab.
Wednesday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
Support comes from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy, one degree at a time. More information at sullivan180.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at wjffradio.org.
This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, partly sunny and breezy, high 65. Tonight we might see a passing shower or two, low 49. Continue to stay in the 60s tomorrow, but rain in the morning, high 69. Some clouds later with a late rain possible in the evening and a low of 55. Wednesday, again, showers possible. Again, a 90% chance of showers, 62 for a high. Cools down a little bit on Thursday to 45. On Point is next.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.